Do you know what your first words were?
I do not.
I know what my first sentence was, because apparently I talked in sentences from the very beginning. And apparently at the age of 12 months, I toddled up to my older brother, whose name was Marty, and I said, much to the horror of the entire family, "Marty, you bad boy." And that became a family legend, that the first thing that was out of my mouth was, "Marty, you bad boy."
Wow. Was it true?
No, he was lovely. He was very nice.
Kyle, do you know yours?
No, I can only imagine it was like ice cream or something like that. Something I might have been
I mean, ice cream is a motif for you, so it would not be shocking.
Emily, if you could guess, like, what would you think your first word would have been?
I know I laughed a lot as a child. Actually, I do know my aunt told me I used to do this thing where, like, if someone ducked their head in a doorway, I would go like, "Hi," like with the tone of like, "Oh my gosh, I haven't seen you in years." And then the person could duck their head back around the door and come back and do it again. And I would do it again.
Welcome to Butter No Parsnips. Every week on Butter No Parsnips, your hosts Emily Moyers and Kyle Imperator take you on an adventure through the weird, wacky, wonderful, and sometimes even wicked world of one wayside word. Strange characters, delightful bits, and general joyousness abound. Join them as they test each other's etymological expertise.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Butter No Parsnips. I'm Kyle Imperator.
And I'm Emily Moyers.
Emily, I've got a real toughie for you today.
Kyle, lay it on me. Honestly, I feel invincible today. I don't think you could give me a word that I couldn't define immediately right now.
Emily, that is sensational. That is great news, because today your word is wug. W-U-G, wug.
I'd like to redact some confidence that I demonstrated earlier.
Okay, well, Emily, maybe this will help.
Yeah, I'll take a hint, because it's the little words that are tough, you know? What do you do with a three-letter word?
It's true. It could fit in so many places. Well, Emily, this is a wug.
What is?
This is.
You've lost me.
You just pay attention, Emily, because now there's another wug. There are two of them. There are two
wugs. Kyle, this isn't a hint.
Emily, instead of letting you flounder like this, how's about we invite the psycholinguist and the coiner of the very word itself, the illustrious Jean Berko Gleason. Hey, Jean, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kyle. Hi, Emily. It's great to be here.
Amazing. Jean, thank you so much for joining us today. Before you help me out with wug, would you mind introducing yourself more fruitfully than Kyle just did?
Okay, I can do so relatively briefly, like in half an hour, or take a little bit of time.
Yeah.
My name is Jean Berko Gleason, and I am a professor emerita in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Boston University. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, the daughter of immigrants from Hungary. And it's important to remember that immigrants made this country. So I want to pay tribute to my immigrant parents. And I went to Radcliffe and then Harvard, where I got my PhD in linguistics and psychology. And I am best known for creating the WUG test and drawing all the pictures, but it's a very well-known study. And in addition to that, every year I deliver the welcome, welcome, and goodbye, goodbye address at the annual Ig Nobel Award show.
So yes, you do.
That I think should be it.
Thank you so much, Jean. And you brought up your WUG test, so we'd love to start simple today. Can you explain a WUG for the audience? What is a WUG?
A WUG is a mythical little creature. I drew it myself, but it's become a much recognized and actually much loved little symbol in the field of linguistics. And it's part of an experiment I did for research many, many years ago, trying to find out if young kids have rules in their heads, even when they're very little, that enable them to deal with language, not just as memorized stuff, but in a creative way, in a way that, for instance, they can make a plural of a word they've never heard before. So the thing you were asking, Emily, this is a wug, now there's another one. If a four-year-old tells you two wugs, that kid is telling you something amazing, because the kid has never heard the word wug before, and it means that they know how to make a plural of a new word. It surprised the world. It surprised everybody that young kids actually have rules in their heads, not just memorized words. If we ask them, if we say, here's a dog, here's another dog, they may have heard people say dogs, but they never heard anybody say wugs. So they had to pull that out of their inner knowledge that they know how to make that plural.
You did things besides plurals, right? You did like verb tenses and things like that?
So what we did, the whole study was English inflectional morphology. Actually, it was English morphology, and that means the meaningful little parts of words. And in English, we have inflections, and inflections are like plurals and past tenses and the present progressive of the verb, things of that sort. An inflection is a way of taking a word and altering it to represent the number of people doing it, whether it's singular or plural, whether it was the past or the present, whether you're doing it right now. So, you know, you have things like one boy, two boys, or he was running, all of those little endings that go on words that don't change the part of the speech of the word, but they tell you whether it was now or a long time ago, or whether it was one person or two, etc. So that's inflectional morphology. Derivational morphology means you're taking a word and you're adding a little thing on the end that makes it into a different word. So that if I say, this is a man who knows how to zib, he's zibbing. What would you call a man whose job is to zib? He's a
zibber.
You got it. He's a zibber. And that is a derivational ending. In other words, you've changed it from he knows how to zib to being a zibber. And that's a really a very, very productive thing in English. You can make that agent ending for practically anything. I mean, we have a lot of words like it, baker, gardener, plumber, all of those kinds of things. But you're given a new word. But the question really is, with kids, when do they know how to do that? You know, and if they don't know how to do it, what do they do? Because you right away say a man who knows how to zib is a zibber. And everybody who's listening knows how to do that. That's a really common, easy thing. Little kids don't know that. They're working on the inflections and not on the making the new parts of speech. So they're liable to say things like, he's a zib man. Which, if you put yourself in sort of a childlike mode, you'll do that too. But I talked about this a lot, and I finally heard from a man one time. He wrote me a letter. He said, "Why are you using my name?" And he signed it, and his name was Zibman.
Zibman.
There are people named Zibman, apparently. But so anyway, good. So kids will do things like that.
I do that all the time when we're working with words on the podcast, and we have to, you know, kind of just play with words to feel it out, what it means and things like that. I feel like a child when I do that.
Well, I'll give you another one. I bet you can do the child kind of thing. Well, let me back up a little bit. We looked first at kids' regular language. What do they have in their language? And the way we looked at it was we looked at children's books. We looked at reports of children's vocabulary. So we made sure that all these things we were testing for to see if they had rules for them actually existed in their spoken speech. You know, there's no point in asking a kid how to make a plural if it's a child who has not yet reached the point where they make plurals. So sure. We wanted to be sure that they had actual words. So the question was, do they have the rules that go with those words? And how did they acquire them? So I'll ask you this one that adults and children do differently. We already talked about this little bird-like creature called a wug, okay? Mm-hmm. So if we show you a picture, we say, this is a wug. This is a very tiny wug. What would you call a very little wug?
A wugette.
A wugette? What else?
I would say a wuglet.
A wuglet? Give me some more.
A wuggie?
Okay. So you see, as adult speakers, you already have a whole bunch of suffixes. Wuggie, wuglet, wugette, wugling. Okay.
Wuggling, yeah.
Wuggling. Isn't it interesting that you have these internalized rules that enable you to make diminutives of words you've never heard before? We were expecting wuggy because in the first place, when people talk to kids, they use diminutives all the time. Okay. Right. They say, it's time to go to Betty and put on your jammies and pick up your footy and nighty-nighty. Okay. Speech to kids is full of those diminutives. And here's a thing about diminutives, the E diminutive like footy, that isn't just little, okay? It's called hypocoristic. It's a diminutive. It means it's small, but you like it. For instance, if you are in a restaurant, okay, and you're eating dinner and you look over on the wall and it's not good, you don't say, look, there's a roachy. Okay, because no matter how little and cute the roach might be, you don't like it. And you're not going to call rats and roaches and infestations and bad things that are little with an E on the end of them, unless you like them. So that's some of the kinds of things that we have with adults that we know how to make all of these diminutive endings. Now, no kid is going to say a very tiny wug is a wugette. Right. Okay. I mean, that's kind of funny. Don't you think of them as like the Radio City Rockettes? Don't you? I think of them, tiny. I think of wugs. If you call it a wugette, I think it's going to line up and kick a
stick. Suddenly it's got high heels and fishnets.
It would be a sexy little one. So, that's not what kids say, actually. It's back to like Zip Man. So what do they call it?
Like a little wug?
They call it a baby wug.
A baby wug.
Now, the thing is that that's a compound word. And you can tell it's a compound word by the stress pattern on it. I'll give you two words. You can tell which one's a compound. Hot dog. Hot dog. Now, what does hot dog mean?
Hot dog is the food item.
And what does hot dog mean?
That's somebody's happy about something.
Or a labradoodle that's sweating.
Yeah.
You got it. Exactly. Okay. I say it's the difference between a wiener and a Weimaraner. Okay. Now, that pattern, hot dog, with the big primary stress on the first syllable and the tertiary stress on the second syllable, that's a compound word. And we don't recognize that frequently because we think a compound word is a word that's written together. The compound word is actually the stress pattern of the word. So we have a lot of words like that in English. We have words like White House and White House. And you immediately know the difference there, too, don't you? White House, what does that refer to?
The place where the president lives.
The place where the president. And White House?
Just a house that is white.
So you see, you've got that. And actually, it's extremely subtle. Nobody teaches it to anybody because they don't know it exists, right? And kids don't really know those differences. They can't do what Kyle did just now until they're about 9 or 10 years old, actually. Takes a long time to recognize the stress pattern that makes the compound worse. But kids have it. They make them even though they can't recognize them.
So we know that that children have this implicit knowledge, right, of language, young children. So what is the implication of that? Like what does it mean and what could it mean that children possess this knowledge?
Now you're touching on like the big fight in the field of linguistics, which I try to stay in the middle of. You know, what does it mean? You're asking what kind of knowledge do they have or how do they come by this knowledge? Mm-hmm. And on the one end, you've got this very nativist group of people who think that you have a machine in your brain, you know, called a language acquisition device, which I don't understand how you could refer to neurology as a device, but we won't get into that. But who think that it's innate, that it's separate, it's a separate faculty that is special to human beings. That's the nativist end. And on the other end, you've got behaviorists who think you can't look inside the black box. You can look at just the stimulus and response, what people have said to kids, of kids being able to use the general laws of learning to do things. Generalization is a learning principle, and you could explain a lot of it by generalization. You could say, well, the kid has heard many thousands and thousands of examples and knows how to generalize from those examples. And in the middle, you've got interactionists. Oh. And interactionists come in many different flavors. And one of them is what you might call a cognitive interactionist, who says, well, language isn't that important. It's cognition. You know, it's we develop our cognitive skills. And on top of the cognition, we add some language in. But it's because we're so smart. And then there's sort of the camp that I'm kind of in, which says, well, what this implies is that you come with good neurology that's ready to do stuff. And it obviously has to be innate. You're born with your neurology, but immense things happen to your brain during the first few years of life. And if you don't have interaction with other human beings, forget it. You're not going to have language. So that's what's called a social interactionist view, which is that language is a social construct everywhere in the world. You know, language is a social thing we agree about. No. And it isn't that children don't get feedback. People think that kids don't get feedback because they labeled the feedback something else. In the early days, people looked at kids' language and they said, look, kid says something like, mommy eat lunch, meaning mommy is eating her lunch. And the parent would say, right, you're right, sweetie. Mommy is eating her lunch. And instead of calling that a correction, they called it an expansion, that the adult takes the child's sentence and expands it. Yeah, but that's also a correction, isn't
it? Right, yeah.
If you realize that that's a correction, you realize that kids are being corrected. Not that people are saying, don't say mommy eating lunch. You know, you don't do that. And don't ever do that to kids, by the way. Yeah. I mean, that's the worst thing in the world you can do to kids is not the worst. There are terrible things you can do to kids. But, to interrupt their attempt to communicate with you, to correct their grammar, is the last thing that you should do linguistically. Because a kid who says, mommy, eat lunch, is at the stage where that's what they do. And you're not going to teach them grammar. And you're ruining your relationship with your child if you do that.
Yeah. So obviously, as we mentioned, the WUG test is like a big moment in the field of psycholinguistics. Did it like have impact in, you know, like early child education and the way that people approached, you know, trying to teach kids language?
Well, you know, it takes a long time for something that is theoretically interesting to make it into the real world. I think that it joined with other kinds of discoveries in developmental psycholinguistics to make people aware of children's language. And not only did I make the WUG test, but I and my colleagues, because there's a bunch of us, published one of the leading textbooks in language development. It's called The Developmental Language. And it's now in its 10th edition. And language development has become recognized as something that's actually happening. And what's changed out in the practical world is that, for instance, if you're becoming a speech pathologist now, if you're going to work with children and help make them better, you have to have had a course in language development. So that whereas I think of our book as psychology, as developmental psychology, it's used much more in language and speech courses for people being trained. So I think that I and other people have been part of getting across to people who work with children the science behind what's going on. And that's an appreciation, among other things, of how they should be stage appropriate with children and do things that help them with the actual language. You know, instead of thinking that, you know, vowels are A, E, I, O, and U. I mean, is to understand what the sounds of language are and how language works.
Can the test be used as a more broader benchmark for cognitive development? Is there a specific point in that it presents itself?
I think the answer to can the WUG test mark cognitive development, I think the answer is no. Okay. Because one, if the child is a bilingual child and performing well in school and is acquiring English, let's say it's a kid who already knows Vietnamese or something, they may actually be speaking English very well and they may be very, very intelligent, but they may not have yet, unlike their age mates, extended the rules for English. I've seen that in kids of that sort. And I think that language and cognition are not the same thing. There are kids who are very good at language who have cognitive problems in there. I don't want to get into syndromes, but there are syndromes where people have better language than other cognitive skills, and the other way around. You can't do it by age, that's for sure, because kids develop at different ages. You know, so a kid could be behind in language and in internalizing these things, but still be a very, very smart kid. So I think it doesn't go the other way around. In other words, Albert Einstein spoke late in life, right? He was a late talker,
sure.
But he wasn't very stupid. I mean, he seemed to be quite bright.
I like to remember him as such, at least.
So somebody can be a quite late talker, but a very, very smart person. Mm-hmm. I have the feeling that somebody who is a very early talker is not liable to be very dumb. The thing is, if you have a kid, they sort of say that, well, first words come around first birthdays. Well, they don't seem to these days. A lot of kids speak later than the first birthday. But if you have a kid who's 12 months old and not saying anything, and then 16 months old and 18 months old, you have an 18-month-old who's not saying much, you might begin really to get worried, although that might be a very smart kid and that kid's going to do fine. So you worry if a kid is late on this general development of language. Yeah. But if a kid says, "Hi, mommy," you know, that's an apple. Well, or "Marty, you bad boy," when is 12 months old,
yeah.
I have a feeling that that's not going to be a kid with cognitive deficits.
Yeah. You know, my brother, I have a younger brother, and when he was young, before he started to speak, he started to talk in nonsense syllables, but mimicking the cadence of real human speech. We go, blah, 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 and we would, you know, have conversations with them as best as we could. I know you've written a lot about whether children are being imitative or if there's more than meets the ear.
Well, what you're describing actually is a well-known phenomenon because it has a name. It's called jargon babbling.
Oh.
Some kids do it, and they're wonderful. You can probably see them on TikTok or something.
Sure.
Because you see a little kid with the telephone going, blah, 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 blah. You know, and it sounds like they're having a conversation. So they have a very good ear for what the cadence of language. What happens is that when kids get to be 5 or 6 months old, I don't want to scare people and put a date on it, you know, because children develop individually, and you shouldn't get worried. But what you see very typically in kids, they get to be 5 or 6 months old, and they begin to babble. And babbling, people say, is like playing with sounds. So the early babbling tends to be repetitive babbling. It tends to be one syllable. It's like ba 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 da 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 ga ga ga. That's early babbling, and that sounds pretty much the same in most languages. But very quickly, babbling begins to take on the characteristics of the language around you. So first you have repetitive babbling, then you get variegated babbling. And variegated babbling means that you put other sounds in. So mm-hmm. you might have said ba 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 to begin with. That's just repetitive. Now you begin to say ba da ba ga ba ba. Okay. You begin to add different sounds into it. So that's variegated babbling. And then some kids go on to babble with the sounds of the language around you. Ba da ga ba da bo ga ba da. You know, we can all do that,
yeah.
And it's fun. So your brother was into jargon babbling. There was a pair of twins that became very famous not too long ago. And people thought they were talking a secret language, you know. And they're wonderful pictures. They were in the news everywhere because the two of them were talking like that to one another and laughing. And the people around them thought, oh, boy, they're telling jokes and we can't understand it, you know. They thought the kids had a secret language. But everybody who has looked at the secret language has said, it's just the sounds of the local language. It's just permutations of the sounds the kids around them hear, basically. But I assure you, he was not, you know, telling you a new theorem or something.
I don't know.
Sure.
I could have been in there, and now he's hiding it from us.
It might have been, but he was just jargon babbling. Did he turn out to be a very social person?
No, actually, quite the opposite.
But it's an interactive thing. Here's an interesting thing. Is that even very little kids vary the way they talk to different people. You are never going to see a kid walk up to a stranger and whine.
Yeah.
Whining is reserved for the folks around you, you know, for your own family. You don't whine at strangers. And even little tiny children know better than to do that. So, I don't know, who did your brother talk to you in jargon babbling?
He talked to all of us, and he would come, like, it wouldn't be, you know, prompted. Like, we wouldn't say something to him necessarily. He would walk right up to us and start at, like, whole conversations, paragraphs.
Yeah. Well, but you know, I'll be Skinnerian about that. He did it at first, and people loved it, and he gave him a wonderful reaction, and he was well rewarded for doing it. So why not repeat it?
Yeah,
that's one of the laws.
It's the first thing I learned in my life.
Yes.
So I guess I'm curious if there's a connection between like the way that like we pick up language and the way that we make new words like through history, like if there are connections between the way that we cognitively like understand language at a young age and then like what prompts us to make new words.
Well, what prompts us to make new words obviously are cultural reasons and societal reasons. True. And creative reasons. You know, we have expression and communication, both of those to do. And the way kids learn words, we were talking about morphological acquisition, obviously those are the bits and pieces of new words. So that if you don't acquire the ability to make a derivational word, then you don't know how to make new words. I mean, you know how to make new words, but the other way we get new words in language, obviously, is because we need them. I mean, we're all talking about LLMs at the moment and an AI. We first begin to say large language model, and then we tired of saying that mouthful of stuff, so we end up saying an LLM. And nobody knew what AI meant. And you know, you can say, oh, those are just initials. But it's not. It's a word, isn't it? What can AI do? Hmm. So AI is a word that we've turned the initials into a word that everybody uses. So I think the kinds of human cognitive linguistics that go into learning the language are part of making new words, obviously. And you can see it happening in over-regularization in some languages. What happens is that languages, when they're in contact with one another, tend to develop forms in each language that come, they borrow words back and forth. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very common for the words to get regularized and for the language itself to get regularized. Because what happens is the speakers have certain tendencies in themselves. In other words, look, irregular words are irregular and you have to learn them separately. And that's not good if you're a second language learner, no. If you're in contact, or if you're a child. And you will hear this. A kid will say, I've fallen down and hurted myself. Okay. The kid doesn't know that hurt takes a zero affix. It's sure. affix in the past. And the kid doesn't know that the past of fell is fall. A fall is felt. Yeah. No, I can't even say it right.
So I just want to clarify to make sure I understand you right. When you say words being regularized, you mean sort of like...
I mean that we take a word that's an irregular... You know, English comes from Old English, as you know better than I do. But as you know, there were a huge number of different forms of the past in the past. I mean, it was very... Who knew how to make the past tense? So we talk about strong verbs and weak verbs and all of those kinds of things. And slowly over the centuries, English has come down to very few different kinds of past tenses. But the tendency to make them regular, and in other words, to take the most common regular form, the past tense, ED, as we say, that comes on, or the DT that comes on the ends of words, we all have that internalized as a productive rule. We don't know when it's a zero ending that you should use. We don't know when the vowel in the middle changes. And our tendency is just to make it regular. And so we're all like fall down and hurted ourselves. That's a cognitive process of generalization we have. Mm. So when we learn new words and new languages, we tend to do that to them as well. The French verb for to speak, dire, je dis, tu dis, il dit, but vous dites, instead of, typically you would say, disait, you know, parler français, and you add that A ending to it. But the speaking in French is irregular, it's dit. But you will find people saying disait. And you will find that, like in Cajun French and in Louisiana, that that's actually the way people might say it. The more languages are in contact, the more there are new speakers, the more those inner cognitive forces take over, and you tend to use the regular patterns because that's the way your brain works, basically. So that's making new words, too. So we've got borrowings, we've got creative stuff, but we've got our own cognition forming it. So what kids do can inform us as to what's liable to happen. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things there is that, for instance, the Scandinavian languages that have been in contact with other languages, you know, where there was a lot of commerce, they tend over the centuries to have become more regular than the ones like Icelandic, which didn't have that much commerce going on.
That's super fascinating. And it digs into, we've covered a couple of pidgin languages on the podcast before, which is like when two languages meet and mix and get super simplified because they need to communicate ASAP.
Yeah. Well, the pidgins tend to become jargons. They tend to move toward becoming language. Ultimately.
Yeah, creoles. Yeah.
If people begin to use them as a native language.
Right.
You know, once you're going to use something as a native language, you've got to be able to say everything.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But when you're creating that sort of simplified melded language on the fly, you're sort of using those techniques that you tested in the WUG test, is making those simple adjustments to words and picking up patterns.
That's right. And that's what I mean for simplicity and regularity, and for not complicated sounds, I must say. Isn't English amazing, the hideous noises it makes? When we talk about first words, you've got to think about what are kids' first words. Well, you know, they might be mama and papa, and they might be owl and apple, but they're not this and that, okay?
Yeah.
They're not thing, even though they're surrounded by things, because who on earth can make a the?
Yeah, or the R sound that English does that's crazy.
Yeah, well, right. But I like to ask people about that TH, because we got two of them. We got the beginning sound in this and the beginning sound in think. And they're different sounds, right? They're made the same way, but the one this, you're also vibrating your vocal folds. It's a voice sound, this. And then think, you're making it the same way. And they're both made the same crazy way that you put your tongue between your teeth and blow. And not only can children not do it, people from France can't do it either. I mean, it's extremely hard to do. And who thinks to make a sound by putting their tongue between their teeth and blowing? But what I like to ask people is this. We write them the same way so people don't realize that they're different sounds. But once you realize they're different sounds, you can ask the question, are they different phonemes? Okay. Are they distinct sounds, or are they just two different ways of pronouncing the, you know, the or the? And do you know the answer to that?
I feel like linguistically they would, like if an F and a V are different phonemes, it's the same voiced unvoiced difference.
Okay, well the test, of course, is if you can find two words that differ only in the difference between those sounds. If you find two words that differ only in the difference between two sounds, then those sounds are individual sounds in the language. So, for instance, you're right, with F and V, you have a word like fest, you know, it's a jab fest, and you have a word like vest. So if you can say fest, vest, and you know right away that they mean different things, you know that F and V are different sounds in English. But let's get back to the Th and the. What do you think about Th and the?
Oh, well, now I don't think they are, because I can't think of any words that are.
You know, it's called a minimal pair. You have to find what's called a minimal pair.
Yeah.
And want me to give you one?
Yes, please. If there is one, please.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Thy and thy.
Oh.
Yeah.
We're better than Wordle here, okay? we ought to make Soundle.
We should
make Soundle. I mean, you're speaking to the right audience, because Kyle will track down any version of Wordle there is.
I just wrote it down. We're going to make it. We're going to make it happen.
Anyway, so we were talking.
Yeah. I want to ask you, you know, we recently spoke with writer Gaston Doran about his experience as a polyglot. And you've done some research on language learning, and by your speaking French, I believe that you are a polyglot yourself.
Sehr gut Deutsch sprechen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Es ist klar und deutlich.
I want to ask you, what do you think helps adults learn and maintain multiple languages? And is there merit to the idea of doing so at an earlier age?
People think that it's just infinitely easier for children than for adults to acquire a language. Right. And work by my colleague Catherine Snow at Harvard has shown that really that's not true, that, you know, adolescents learn language extremely well as well. But what is different is that young kids are better at phonology. You know, what happens is that you get frozen into English sounds, but if early on you learn how to make those other sounds, you'll be more flexible, I think. The other thing is it's easier if you're younger because people are nicer to you. I mean, let's say you want a kid to give you a ball, okay? Let's say the kid is two or three. You say, sweetie, give me the ball. and the kid doesn't. And you say, sweetie, here, see the ball? Look at the ball. Give mommy the ball. You're really nice to them. Some poor stranger who clearly doesn't speak English, you yell at them. You say, get in the ball. Yeah. You know, you don't have a good experience. Have you been to France? Try to speak English? I mean, you know, people are not nice to you unless you're a kid. And since we're learning language from other people, it helps to have a friendly and supportive environment. The other thing is that there are huge individual personality differences in learning many languages. I mean, I do weird things, you know, I'll stand in the shower, you know, and I'll say to myself, ich weiß nicht, was alles bedeutet, das nicht so traurig bin. And I don't know why I do that, but I just tend to practice things in other languages because they're fun. Yeah. Have a good time. But other people won't open their mouth. They're afraid they'll make a mistake. So there are huge individual differences. But when you're little, you know, you have more support and more help and less likelihood that you'll be mortified. You know, a lot of people are just don't want to take a chance. They don't want to open their mouth and have people laugh at them. Or they're so stuck in their own individual who they are. And they are not a person who speaks French. They used to think that after the age of puberty, you could not learn another language like a native speaker. But I hope people have given up on that. You know, that you may have some trouble with pronunciation, but puberty, there's no big pubertal mark in your brain that says, okay, now you can't do another language. But people used to really think that, you know, that for something happened in puberty. But I don't think it does, and I don't think anybody thinks that anymore.
I wanted to ask you, Jean, you've studied how multilingualism can affect different emotional responses. And I think what you were just speaking about touches a little bit upon that, depending on if a polyglot is listening to their first language or not. How do memory and language work together? And what are the implications here for better understanding how we perceive language?
Well, let's talk about not just memory, Kyle, but let's talk about emotion, because language is in your body. Mm-hmm. So I think the thought that language is just in your head is a big mistake. I guess they have a term now, you know, embodiment for a lot of psychological stuff. So obviously, memory makes a difference because you remember things that have happened to you. And if you think about your head, and if you think that every word in your head had a little light on it, okay, if you have a big vocabulary and a long history, those words are connected together. And they all have not just cognitive, but they have emotional connotations as well. So that when I say a word like doctor to you, your doctor light goes on, but also all the little tiny lights attached to doctor, like nurse, hospital, sick, hate, ugh, you know, all the horrible things that I'm sorry, and all the wonderful things, research, invention, respect, whatever you feel about doctors, but all those little lights go on. So you've got a semantic network there, and that's partly cognitive, because that's your brain, it's the wiring in your brain, okay? But it's also partly emotional, because all those words have emotional connotations. You don't just know the word hospital, you know the horrible time you had when you had to go to the emergency room. And so hospital is tinged with that for you. And what we found, my colleague Catherine Caldwell Harris at Boston University, what we found was that if you take not just taboo words like bad, dirty words, and I know that we probably can't say dirty words here, but if you take a native speaker, Kyle, you talked about your little brother, but if I say to you, not just dirty words, but if I say to you, don't touch daddy's things, if we hooked you up to a machine like a polygraph, you know, whatever the current version is, when I say those mean things to you, you have a physiological reaction in your whole body. Okay. And you acquired those when you were little, when people said to you, don't do that. You have an emotional reaction to that because somebody said that to you when you were little, and it goes along with those words. Now, in a second language, especially learned a little later, if I say, you know, tu es méchant, you know, you're bad, or méchante if you're a girl, whatever, it's not going to have the same effect on you because you didn't learn it under emotional circumstances. So that's a big difference between a first and a second language. We wrote an article, I never remember the names of it, but it had to do with taboo words and reprimands. So it was not just dirty words. Because have you noticed that you could swear more easily in another language than in your native language?
Yeah, it doesn't feel as taboo.
It doesn't, because you don't have all those heavy, heavy emotional connections. I am of the generation where people did not say bad words, okay? I mean, to me, for instance, crap is a bad word. I can't say crap. It means something very bad to me. Mm-hmm. So needless to say, I can't say shit. I can't say that. I can say merdalor in French, sure. Or I can say Scheiß auf Deutsch without any problem at all. Okay, because I learned them much later, and they don't have that heavy emotional load on them. So there's a huge difference there.
That is fascinating, Jean. I want to go back for a second. You were talking about semantics before, and I do want to put in here for the podcast that there is a semantics wordle called Semantle that deals with semantics. So just in case anybody out there needs that in their life. But Jean, we're going to move on to our own game here on the podcast. But before we do, we'd like to ask you, is there something that you'd like our audience to know? Anything at all? What do you have on your mind?
Oh, we're wrapping up. I thought this was just the first hour.
We're going to take a lunch break.
All right. Well, listen, the project, as I said before, we've turned out 10 editions of book on language development. What I'm working on now, what I did earlier today was I'm working with some colleagues on an AI project.
Oh.
And what we have just done is given the WUG test, a version of the WUG test, to LLMs. So we've got a paper coming out on, look, nobody knows how AI works.
Yeah.
All right. I can't tell you all the answers right now.
Sure.
And of course, since it's not phonological, since it's written on, it's a little bit different.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, we do find, I mean, for instance, we do find, you know, some interesting things. And it's coming out in a paper that is going to be in camera ready copy on Monday. So that's my colleague, my colleagues, Patrick Jwola at Duquesne University and George Mikros. And he's at a Greek university, I believe. And Lisa Men from the University of Colorado and Dan Bernstein Ratner from University of Maryland. So that is what I am doing right now. If you think you get old and just fade away, no, you don't.
It's not true. No.
Once you're an academic, can't stop. We can't quit. You know, we quit because we die. But other than dying, we just have a terrible time stopping.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been doing lately.
Yeah. Exciting. Jean, that is so exciting.
That sounds
exciting.
Super fascinating. And I'm absolutely going to look out for that.
Yeah. We talk about AI a lot. I mean, everybody's talking about AI now. So that's a really important paper.
And that's why it's a new word everybody's going to have, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, guys, are you ready to play a little bit of a game?
I'm so ready.
I don't know.
So our game today is called Nonce Sense 2, Ensconced in Nonce. British listeners who take pause with this title can go to episode 17 of our Patreon-exclusive podcast, Buttered Parsnips, for our official position on Nonce. But that is for another day. So Emily knows this game. She came up with it. This is a game that we've played in a previous episode, but this time it has a little bit of a twist for our listeners. Jean, as much as we hoped you were, you aren't the only researcher, psycholinguistic or otherwise, to use a nonce word in the pursuit of higher knowledge. There have been any number of scientific experiments which have used their own nonce words to make for a better experiment. Unfortunately, the point of these nonce words is to not have a definition. So, to keep things fair, I'm going to list off three words, and hiding in those three words will be a nonce word used in an experiment. If you can identify which word is the experiment word, you will get the point. Does that make sense?
It does, but I'm, this is a game I've not played, so I hope you'll forgive me if I turn out to be an idiot.
That's okay. We are coming in equally blind here, Jean.
Okay, so your first three words are Blauert, Blicket, and Bloffert. Can you tell me which of those words was used in a scientific study?
Blicked.
I'm going to side with Jean because she's got a lot of confidence.
Yes, you are correct. Blicket is the nonce word there.
Can we quit now while we're ahead? Yeah.
Jean, do you want to talk to us at all about Blicket before I give a little spiel about it? Do you know more about Blickets?
Well, Blickets, you know, here's the thing is that Blickets they're not very interesting to look at.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's a fair description too. I have heard that Blickets were introduced by Nancy Soja in her 1987 paper, Ontological Constraints on Two-Year-Olds' Induction of Word Meanings. But they weren't popularized until 2000, thanks to a paper called The Blicket Within, Preschoolers' Inferences About Insides and Causes. And basically, the paper involved researchers presenting children with a novel object called a Blicket that would activate a machine, and they basically determined that young children had the sophisticated ability to reason out the insides of the objects and their causal roles from that.
Okay.
The other two words that I mentioned, blawort is the cornflower of the Centaurea cyanus plant, and a bloffert is an old European coin. Is a bloffert.
So those are both real words.
Those are both real words,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I believe it.
Okay. Are you guys ready for round two?
Yes.
Yeah, this one's Emily's.
Oh, this one's Emily's. She's going to get it. She's going to get it. Your words are Zaz, Czar, and Zax.
Oh, I mean, Zax is a Dr. Seuss, but I don't think that was a study. What were the other ones? Czar
and Zaz.
I'll say Zaz. That sounds the funnest.
Is Czar, right?
It's actually Zaz. Emily got it.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, you were shaking your head. I'm sorry. I see you. And when she said Zaz, you shook your head. So I said, well, there's got
to
be Czar. Okay.
I like to
Emily,
her
you
out.
Win that one.
All
and
right.
It's a big prize. I hate to tell you, you get a wonderful prize. And Kyle's going to give it to you.
Yeah, I'm going to give it to you. And the prize is what a Zaz is. So Zaz was used in a paper called Social Categories as Markers of Intrinsic Interpersonal Obligations. Researchers Marjorie Rhodes and Lisa Chalik studied how children perceive social categories and the pursuant moral obligations to those categories. So this is what they did. In the study, Zazzes and flirps were introduced to present the moral question of whether or not harming someone was wrong. And the interesting result was, while earlier research showed that children themselves were more often averse to doing harm to others, even when a rule did not exist against it, when the children were made a third party and told that Zazzes were allowed to harm flirps, children were like, yeah, okay, that sounds great.
So that makes you understand Donald Trump, doesn't it?
Yes.
No, many recent acts of violence against people. Once you give people permission, you know, that I hate to extrapolate from that, but if you give people permission to do bad things, or if you model that, and that's back to behavior, you know, if it's not just models, it's not just a person who punches another person, but it's a respected person who punches another person. It's somebody you admire, you know, that's going to make a lot of people do it. Yeah. So we're in danger, folks.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've talked about that on the podcast. We could get into that. That could be the next hour of the podcast. But
that's right. Yeah. I'm ready to go. No, it's true. It's true.
So the other two words there, Czar is a religious set of beliefs and practices in parts of Northern Africa and the Middle East that involve the possession of an individual, usually female, by a type of spirit. That's what Czar is. And Zax is a tool similar to a hatchet used to prepare slate for roofing. A Zax.
Okay.
So round three, this is the last round. This is for all the marbles. Your words are Takamaka, Takahe, and Takete.
These don't sound familiar to me at all, any of them. Takamaka, Takahe, Takete. Oh. Okay. Well, I'll go with Takamaka.
I'll go with Takete.
Takete.
Takete. Oh. Now that you said it with that inflection,
make you change your mind?
No, I'm going to stick with that because I think Takahei, I feel like it wouldn't be a word that has like a weird pronunciation thing like that H. I feel like that is something that would be avoided in a made up word for an experiment. So I'm going to say Takate. Takete.
Takete. Emily, you're right. Takete okay. is the noun word.
Very good. Very good.
And okay. it's funny that you bring that up, the sounds there, it's because Takete, along with its counterpart Maluma, are early predecessors to the more recent Kiki Booba effect.
Those have to do with guessing what size things are from the sound. Is that right?
Yeah.
We used to make those examples. We'd make them up, like baluba and tiki-tiki. You know, one's a baluba and one's a tiki-tiki. And one would be a long stick and the other would be a round thing.
Right.
And everybody knows the difference between a baluba and a tiki-tiki.
Yeah.
You know, and it's half the same thing. My cat has just arrived.
Beautiful. Baluba is actually an alternative for Maluma. So yeah, it was introduced by Wolfgang Kurler in 1929 in his Gestalt Psychology. So for those unfamiliar, basically Kurler presented people with a drawing of a sharp-edged figure and a soft rounded figure and asked them which one's Takete, which one's Maluma. And they strongly preferred Takete for sharp and Maluma for round. And it points at the potential relationships that may exist between cognition, language, and the development of the alphabet. The other words, takamaka is another plant of the Calophyllum takamahaka plant, and a takahei is a large flightless bird of the Rallidae family, endemic to New Zealand.
I was going to say it sounded Maori.
I picked takamaka because it was easier to pronounce. I couldn't say the other two. I figured, okay, I got to stop my cat. He's a touch screen here. He's going to undo us.
Well, thank you so much, Jean, for coming on the show today to talk about all of this with us.
You want to hear about the wug store quickly?
Yeah.
Okay. If people want to see what a wug looks like, you can go to the wug store on the internet, wug store, WUGSTORE.com. And you can see all kinds of, you don't have to buy anything. You can just look. And the wug test is there available too. Wugstore.com. Now I've done my shameless, whatever it's called.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Jean, for joining us today for this absolutely fascinating conversation. And listeners at home, remember you can find Butternut Parsnips on social media, on Facebook and Instagram at Butternut Parsnips Podcast, and on TikTok at Butternut Parsnips. And if you like today's episode, consider giving us a 5-star rating or review wherever you heard us.
And if you really like today's episode, consider donating to our Patreon at patreon.com/butternutparsnips. Donating $5 or more earns you a shout out either on social media or here on the podcast.
Thanks so much to all of you. You help us make what we make.
And with that, I've been Kyle Imperator.
And I've been Emily Moyers. And you've been
Jean Burko Gleason.
And this has been Butternut Parsnips.
Butternut Parsnips is produced by Kyle Imperator, Emily Moyers, and myself, Seth Glicksman. The main and accompanying themes were composed by Kyle Imperator.